Good morning from Radio Entrepreneurs, sharing the success of entrepreneurship. And we're filling in for Jeff Davis today. This is John Dustin from JED Insurance, along with my co-host Peter Meyerson from Cohen Resnick and Meyerson. Good morning, Peter.
And Plowd, if I leave out that partner's name, he gets mad.
And we're here today with Fred Golder of Bernstein, Golder and Miller, attorney, educator, writer, and Renaissance man. Good morning.
Good morning. It's great to be here. The reason I'm here really is because of this amazing book I wrote, When God Looked Down and Wept.
So tell us about it.
All right. Well, it's kind of interesting. For years and years, I've been an advocate for workers, and I've represented workers. And in my spare time, I was involved with the Civil Rights Division or section of the Anti-Defamation League. And one day I got a call from Leonard Zakim before it was a bridge. He was an amazing man, and he was the regional director in New England. And he called me up, and I was on the Civil Rights Committee. He said, Fred, I have a case for you. I said, I am up to my ears in cases. I can't take any more cases. He says, you've got to take this case. I said, I can't take the case. So he called me. It was hard to say no to Len. And then finally, the third time he called me, he said, you got to take the case. He was fired for being too Jewish. I said, all right, that was it. I said, in the United States, you can be too Jewish, you can be too Muslim, you can be too Christian. So that was the beginning of an amazing adventure that I had with this gentleman who was born it was on a border town between Czechoslovakia, Romania. It kept switching back and forth depending on Hungary. And he told me about his life. And when you're getting ready for trial and when you're meeting someone, you get to sort of get a measure of this person. And he starts telling me about his life and his experience, and I'm fascinated. And he starts to tell me about how he wasn't even 16 years old. The Nazis came. They took him by train transport. He told me the story, and I wanted to know the details. Everybody sort of has an understanding of the Holocaust, but I wanted to know. And he finally, reluctantly, told me his story. And it was just an amazing, incredible story. And coupled with his story, of course, I was in the middle of getting ready for a trial, his trial. He was terminated for being too Jewish from a school system, public school system in Massachusetts. Maybe the name is going to remain unnamed at the present. But the reason he got hired, they had a policy, this particular town, that if 12 parents petitioned, the town had to offer a program. And the parents in this particular town...
Sounds like a minion.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So here he was. The parents got together, they petitioned the town, and they wanted Hebrew as a foreign language. So they looked around the school, and they finally found my client, Benjamin. They said, wow, we'll hire this guy. They hire him.
So your client is Benjamin?
Yes, he is. And he works for them for 5 years. He becomes... Now, remember now, the town did not want to offer Hebrew as a foreign language. But because the parents petitioned, they were obligated to do it. So while he's teaching Hebrew, he doesn't know what's going on behind the scenes. They're trying to discourage people from taking Hebrew. So while Hebrew is declining, the enrollment is declining, when the students had finally graduated, there wasn't a need for a Hebrew teacher to teach Hebrew classes. And they always considered him to be the Hebrew teacher. He wasn't a teacher teaching foreign language. He was the Hebrew teacher.
Was he tenured at that point?
Yes. Now, here's the good part, the interesting part. So now he's a tenured teacher. He's been there now for 5 years. He's a gifted teacher, gets wonderful evaluations. However, Italians declining enrollment, Hebrew declining enrollment. By the way, he also taught, certified to teach social studies, and he even taught social studies for 1 year. So he teaches, and they have to decide. They've got two people. They have him, and they have a much younger non-Jewish teacher teaching Italian. They have to reduce somebody in force, and who is it going to be? Is it going to be the older Jewish teacher that looks like a rabbi? And by the way, there was testimony that he was taking advantage of the Jewish holidays. Why couldn't he be like all the other Jews? He only takes off Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. He took off Shavuot, Sukkot, because to him, that's what an observant Jew did. And the school committee didn't like that either. The school department didn't like that either. So they had many reasons. First, he was too Jewish. He took off the Jewish holidays. And lo and behold, they decided he was going to be the one to go. And so that's how I came to meet him. And it was one of the most amazing cases. Now, I don't want you to think that I'm a shy kind of person, because I've taken on General Motors, Ford Motor Company, United States, U.S. Airways. I'm not bashed. In fact, I even sued the New England Patriots on behalf of one of my clients at one time, successfully, but kind of an interesting story. I got to cross-examine Bob Kraft and his whole crew there. It was really very fun.
That must have been interesting, but
exciting.
Tell us more about God, when God looked down and wept.
Okay.
Is there a passage you'd like to read that would be helpful? Well,
there's so many different nooks and crannies. When he first was taken by transport, they drop him off, and they're there for 3 days and three nights on the train. Nobody knows where they're going. They don't know what's happening to them. And he gets off the train, and he walks up on a line. All he sees is a line, and he sees this man who is dressed impeccably. And very quickly, he's going left, right. He's pointing left, right, left, right. And he doesn't know what to make of it. He's not quite 16 years old, and he sees this going on. And he notices that the old, the sick, the infirm, almost everybody's going to the left. And only a few, very few people are going to the right. Strong, healthy-looking men and some women. Very few. So he decides he wants to go to the right. He doesn't know how he's going to get there, but he knows he wants to go to the right. So goes up to the front of the line, and just before he gets his turn in line, there's a woman. They send the woman to the right. They take the baby away to the left. Oh. And she's screaming, "I want to go with my baby. I want to go with my baby." And they don't know what to do. So the man shakes his head, "Let her go with her baby to the left," which of course was instant extermination. So he gets up there. He doesn't know what to say. And the man in front of him says, "How old are you in German?" And of course, he doesn't understand German, but because he knows Yiddish, he understood he was asking him how old he was. And he said he was 18. He wasn't 16. He had never lied in his life. He came from a very religious background. He doesn't know where it came from. He doesn't know how he said it. He couldn't rehearse it. He said he was 18. And because he said he was 18, he sent him to the right. Now, later on, he found out who the man was in the front of the line.
And who was
it? It was Dr. Mengele. Joseph Mengele was pointing where people were going. He learned about that later. Now he's in the camp, and they say, "How old are you?" And then he says, well, he thought that if he told them he was younger, they'd put him in children's camp, which would be a safer place. They would treat him nicer in the children's camp. So he gets into the camp and he tells them his true age, and they send him in the kinder block, and where all the children are. And he's there, and he's not there for an hour or two, and one of the people that were there, one of the inmates, calls him over to the fence, and they start talking. And he said, where do you come from? Where's your family? He said, "Oh, my family, they went to the other camp." The guy shook his hand. He said, "There is no other camp. Your parents are dead. They've been exterminated. They've been cremated. They're gone. You've got to survive. And the only way you're going to do that is you've got to get out of the camp you're in. Every 3 weeks, Everybody in the Kinder block and where the children are kept, they all get killed. Everyone gets cremated, and they send another three. All go to the ovens, and they send another group. And they have that there, so when the Red Cross comes, they see, look how well we treat our children, which is not true. You've got to get out of here. So as luck would have it, they came and they wanted people to go to work. And he volunteered to go to work, and that's how he got out of Auschwitz.
Wow.
And from Auschwitz, he got to a place called Mauthausen in Milk, and he wound up, he was there for over a year. He survived, which is like incredible. And the most amazing thing I found about this man, despite what one might have thought was, how can you believe in God after this? How can you believe in a God that would let this happen? He never lost his faith. Never lost his faith in God. He continued to be an observant Jew even when he finally was liberated in May of 1945.
So your personal connection to the story probably really pushed your heart in the case, I would imagine.
It was amazing. Now, I had my daughter's father-in-law said, you don't want to write another book about the Holocaust because there's so many other books, but you have a really interesting twist. You have a book that talks about the Holocaust, but you can combine it with the trial. So the book starts out,
oh, wow.
The book starts out, the jury has now heard the evidence, and they're now deliberating, and here he is thinking back to his life. So it has flashbacks to the past, and then it comes back to the present, and you've got flashbacks back and forth. And so really the theme of the book is he survived the Holocaust by one miracle after another, because it was a miracle that he survived. Would he survive the American judicial system? That's the question I have to leave everybody. And if you want to know the answer to that question, you have to read the book.
Did Alan Dershowitz jump on board with this case? I would imagine.
Now, that's an interesting question that you'd ask, because his name came up.
Okay.
His name came up, and he actually, Benjamin asked, can't you get me Alan Dershowitz to represent me in this Jewish, this discrimination case? And Len said, if you want to try a lawyer, you get Fred Golder. That's how I got to be the one. He could have, Lenny Zagin could have gone to anybody. Anybody would have been glad to do this. He had to come to me because that's what I did for a living. I try cases.
How long of a process is it between when you ended the trial and got the book together and through editing, and is it a long process? It
took me a long time. I had a great deal of material. As I said, it took a while for him to get this out, and I was putting it all together. I took depositions of him so that I would have it all preserved. And I didn't have the time, unfortunately, because I was a little busy trying cases. But when my trials started to slow down around 2004, 2005, I had an opportunity to focus, and I started to work and put it together. And eventually, it became a book, and I have a film that I show with the book, and I've been going to many different places. I've spoken at libraries, I've spoken at historical societies, I've been around talking about the book. And the most important thing for me is to get the story out so people understand that 6 million is so hard to grasp. The individual stories are so much more important and so much more vital to understanding what went on during this time that he calls unspeakable.
Where is the book predominantly sold? Is it in Barnes and Nobles? Is it more online?
I would say that most of the time people either go to Amazon, which is readily available on Amazon, or they go to Barnes and Noble. Those are the two places. Although I suspect that if you went to any bookstore, they would probably be able to have that available.
Well, any bookstore can buy it.
Of course.
You know, of course. But,
of course.
But so your distribution is basically online.
That's right.
Yeah.
Which is where most of the books are these days.
Yeah, that is for sure. That is for sure. Have you tried to get a book deal?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I wrote another book before this, and it was a small publisher outside of Philadelphia, and they published the book. It was a book on the law. It was called Uncivil Rights, A Guide to Workers' Rights, which was pretty good. It did well. And it came time that this book was pretty much in manuscript form, and I called the publisher, and I said, I have a book. You think there might be somebody that you might know that would publish something like this? And he said, well, why don't you send me the manuscript? I'll look into it. And he said, I'll do this one. And he really, really liked it. And so he decided to do it. And he, this small publisher in Pennsylvania, and I never really bothered to look anywhere else because I'm not really that concerned about selling it and making money. What I'm really want to do most is to get out there, talk to people, get them to understand that what happened in Germany could happen anywhere. In fact, it is happening in other places where people are killing other people for no other reason than their religious beliefs. Look what's happening in the Middle East. You've got the Sunnis and the Shiites killing each other for no other reason than they don't follow the same religious tenets. And I find it really sad, and I'd like to be able to start a dialogue, a conversation, so that people start thinking in different ways.
There was an Armenian genocide of over 1 million plus in the early 1900s as well.
Exactly. And it's going on, and we have to stop it. And the way to stop it is to, I think, to tell more people about what's going on so that it doesn't happen again.
I think it's a great story, Fred.
I was going to say, on a smaller level, it's amazing that a town or city would have a wrongful termination case of that magnitude with a school committee, a superintendent, school officials. It's just, you know, right in front of them to do that is kind of crazy.
Well, let me put it this way. When the case happened, discrimination wasn't as prevalent. It is, for example, now people are less reticent about coming forward, standing up for themselves. Things are happening now. The Civil Rights Act was passed in 1964, but for some strange reason, very few people did this kind of law. I'll tell you an interesting little story. When I was in the beginning of my practice in the early 70s, I went to New York City, and they had a conference. This was in the 70s. And in the conference, I met Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was one of the panelists talking about women's issues and women's rights, talking about sex discrimination. Now, sex harassment wasn't even an issue in those days because nobody knew what it was in the 70s. But so I asked her, I said, how many people are representing workers from the plaintiff's perspective? This was in the 70s. And she said, in New York City, she said, you can count them on one hand. There was nobody practicing this. Nobody was protecting workers. And I said, gee, Ralph Nader's got the consumers. Let me focus on workers. So from that day on, I started focusing on advocating for the rights of workers. And I did that my whole career.
So it's a great story, Fred. And the book is very impressive. You know, and the story you tell is really kind of mind-boggling and needs to be told over and over and over and over and over.
Which is exactly what I'm planning to do, and which I am doing. I've spoken to many different venues, and I'm going to continue to speak as long as much as I can. And I'm doing this really out of respect for Benjamin because he wants the story to be told. He didn't tell the story to anybody for 40 years. Until he came to me. And he explains in the little film clip I have why he didn't tell the story. First of all, he said to tell it is almost trivializing it because it's unspeakable. The crime is so horrendous. It's an unspeakable crime. And he said the second reason he never talked about it, or the survivors never talked about it, they didn't think the world would care. Because he said if the world cared, they would not have let it happen.
It's fascinating. If somebody wanted to get a hold of you, Fred, can you give them your contact information?
Sure. Telephone number.
That works.
Area code 617-927-9590. Email address. Everybody has those. F as in Fred, T as in Thomas, Golder, G-O-L-D-E-R, @gmail.com. So if you use either one of those sources, you can get in touch with me.
It's been great talking to you. This is Peter Meyerson from Cohen Raznick, Meyerson and Plout, and John Dustin from JED
Insurance.
I get the acronym right?
Yes.
And we've been sitting in for Jeffrey Davis as best we can, because that inimitable figure is always inimitable. And we are at Radio Entrepreneurs, and we are broadcasting from MPT Software in Framingham. They're graciously been allowing us to do that. And we will be back after these messages.